So here we are on the next lecture on writing the history of the First World War. I've been going through the first class was mostly about sources, and then about the different configurations of historiography, the different configurations of history. And I spoke first of all of the military and diplomatic, and then went on to the question of social history. And in every case, these reacted to changes in society. Social history came about because there were more historians and more working class historians, and it was an explosion. And also the different forms or an expansion of history. It's the idea of what history is has got bigger. And I mentioned that in the 20s, the story of the individual soldier was not considered to be history, and that became history later on. And there are more things which are becoming history as we go along. So I just slide up or down to whereabouts I more or less was. Yes. I'd got as far as the final slide on social history, which was social aspects of the Great War, and various attempts that have been made. This one before the Second War, that's why it says sexual history of the World War, because there was only one at the time, by Magnus Hirschfeld. This one here, the British working class and enthusiasm for war, I remember I mentioned. The stomach for fighting, and here you got into kind of history where nobody was really quite sure if it is social history or if it is cultural history. And you can see, in fact, the editors decided it was cultural history. At the top it says, cultural history of modern war. And one more here, which has the word culture in it, soldiers and the culture of caregiving. So the culture of caregiving, it's more than just what did the nurses do. It's also how did the nurses see what a man was, what a wounded man was, what were their conceptions of caregiving? What did they think was the normal things to do in those situations? And in particular, there's whole sections in this book about how terribly difficult it was for wounded soldiers, because they were at the time extremely well. Even today, we're very timid, but at the time, they were even more timid about bodies. And it was absolute terrible for the soldiers who were not frightened, who were not really frightened of war. They were terrified of the nurses washing them, absolutely terrified. And there were many cases where they would, you know, find some way of avoiding the nurses washing them because it was so embarrassing. Yeah, there was very, 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 very strict separation of men and women, very, very tense relationship with all this, which went through all parts of society. Even though in working class families, of course, the children, you had very little space. You could have five children in one room. That would not be unusual. The working class families often went to extreme lengths to make sure that when they washed, the girls were separate from the boys. Yeah, it was very, very important to people. And this is something which appears in here. But let's move directly on to the third field. The third field, c'est en français qu'on disait configuration, en anglais j'avais des fields. And this is the idea, in fact configuration was better in a way, because it was the idea that first of all the military and diplomatic history came along and dominated the writing of history, and then social history came along and dominated the writing of history for 20 years, although the military and diplomatic continued. And finally, since the 1980s, cultural history is dominating, until today, the writing of history, which is good. But what is cultural history? Would you like to try what is cultural history? No, I wouldn't like to try either. Let's try our dictionary, okay? Let's look at the dictionary. There you go, it's gone round and done. And if I open up my dictionary, I look in my dictionary, special Oxford dictionary, as you know, Oxford is a very big dictionary, very important dictionary, very substantial dictionary. And it said no exact match found for cultural history in British and World English. So the Oxford dictionary doesn't know what it is, so how are we supposed to know what it is? So obviously there's something problematic in some way. Yes, social history was no problem to find a definition. Cultural history is more problematic. Not easy to define. Because and it has a number of different aspects, so it's not there's no very strict line which divides it from social history and so on. And it comes from the universities in the 1980s, and it is pushed along by a number of changes. First of all, a mixing of disciplines where people who were experts in literature are also interested in history. People who are experts in psychology might also be interested in history. And you see, mixing together different disciplines is one of the bases of cultural history. The second is the decline in the universities and everywhere else, the decline of the influence of Marxism. Marxism was quite influential in 1965. And in 1968 in France, of course, in the universities, it was and little by little in the university, among the university professors, the influence of Marxism has been declining. There's still a few Marxists around. It's funny because English people think that French universities are full of Marxists, yeah, because they've seen all these films about 1968. Whereas, in fact, I think among university professors, I think I have met four Marxists in my entire career. Yeah, so, you know, there are not so many of them around. In any case, the decline of the influence of Marxists. Now, the influence of Marxists was not something dishonest. Some of the greatest English historians, Eric Hobsbawm, A.J.P. Taylor, E.P. Thompson, some of the greatest ones were in the Communist Party in the 60s. Very often they left later. So, you know, Marxist history had a reason to be influential. But it was its decline was underway. And in some ways, cultural history is a compromise between those historians who are still influenced by Marxism. They're not Marxists, but they think that, you know, Marxism has a lot of useful things to say. And people who want to talk about literature, psychology, philosophy, and so on. It's kind of compromise which allows the university to continue without too many conflicts. So to go back to the declining influence of Marxism, of course, one of the political phenomena which accompanied the decline in the influence of Marxism is the collapse of the Eastern Bloc. The Soviet Union collapsed in 1992. And although many Marxists were not very happy with the Soviet Union, it was generally considered to be that once the Soviet Union collapsed, it was harder to be a Marxist. It was more difficult, unless you had some explanation of why the Soviet Union collapsed. Because in the 60s, the communists thought, well, there are many things wrong with the Soviet Union, but it's better than Western capitalism. But then when it collapsed, it was a bit difficult for them to stick with that. I'm not going to go into that too much. Some of the new historians insisted that the most important thing was to abandon what they call the grand narrative. And this is because some of the communist parties defended a very simplified view of history, where automatically feudalism becomes capitalism, and automatically capitalism collapses and communism rises. Now, this was not Marx's opinion. This is a simplified kind of Stalinist view of history. But let's say that the version of Marxism that everybody knew about was this rather simplified version, which they wanted to get away with. And so there's quite often then the idea of rejecting grand narratives. We don't want grand narratives. That's of course not everybody was saying that, but many, many historians were saying in the 1980s, we don't want grand narratives. Now, that's kind of useful in a way, but that's just what we don't want, and you still have to find what we do want to get on with this. So what did they do with that? Well, some people. So you have the small number of Marxists who remain. you have a lot of people who say, well, we'll take a little bit of ideas from Marx, which are the very useful ones, yeah, but we're not interested in grand narratives. And then you had people who went even further who called themselves the postmodernists. Yeah, it's not the modern society, it's the postmodern. We're after modern. That was modern, was yesterday. There are many different versions of this, but in the most acute versions, this was the idea that it is impossible to write truth about the past. Yeah. Now, some of the Stalinist Marxists said there is only one truth about the past, which I think is a very not a good way of looking at the world. But the other extreme was, it is impossible to write truth about the past. Every document is subjective. There is only subjectivity. If you write a history and you write a history, they are equally valid because there is no ultimate truth about the past. Now, these were mostly people who came from philosophy and from literary studies. Most historians did not agree with this, but this is normal, you know. If you're a historian and then somebody tells you it's impossible to write truth about the past, well, you don't really have a job anymore. You're a bit out of a job, really. There are whole books written about this. There's a guy, Rorty, I think, is the guy who wrote about, you know, why you can no longer write truths about the past. It doesn't seem to... My personal opinion is it's not very interesting. It's just like, for example, I could say, I cannot say anything true about this room, because in fact I only have little bits of light, photons. I don't have any real proof that you are here. I just have little bits of light. This is true. I just have little bits of light and vibrations in the air. I don't have any direct evidence. This is true, but it's not interesting. It doesn't allow me to go anywhere. So I prefer to believe that you are really here and I'm really talking to you. And in the same way, I prefer to believe that it is possible to write truths, plural, about the past. I certainly think it is possible to write truths about the past. I think when they bring out a new book, which shows that in the 19th century, although we have an image of women being very passive and staying at home, in fact, it's much more complicated than that. I think that this is making public new truths about the past. And I think that's quite important, obviously. Otherwise, I wouldn't be a historian. To get back to cultural history then, a couple of things. I gave you a couple of the causes. I would also say that, so what are some of the themes of cultural history, the subjects they were interested in? Well, one of the very, very big words is representations. Cultural historians were very interested in representations. What does representations mean? Well, let's imagine we're writing a history of this university. A cultural historian might be interested in saying, what is the difference of how students saw the university in 1968 and today? Because, of course, in 1968, there was a small number of people going to university. It was much more elitist. And they had a particular view coming from the economic boom and so on. And what's the difference with today? How do students look at the university? What do they expect? What do they think is reasonable? What do they think is unreasonable? Do they see it in a utilitarian way? Oh, I don't really like university, but if I don't have a diploma, I'll never get a job. Or do they see it in an idealistic way? I am discovering the world of knowledge. Forget it. Okay. So that would be a cultural history of students in France. How have their views? Also, there's a link, of course, with the real lives of students. Did they have to go to work to pay for their studies? Did their parents give them money for their studies, etc.? There's a link to the real lives. But one of the emphases of cultural historians is what is their representations. And I gave you the example a moment last week of Ilana Bet-El, this woman military historian who wrote about the conscripts. And one of her big questions was, did the conscripts who were obliged to join the army, did they think of themselves as soldiers or as civilians with guns? Yeah, because they only joined the army because they were obliged to. Yeah? And so all the different ways of what they considered to be reasonable. So that's one of the elements. Representations is very important, that to such an extent that we sometimes talk about the history of representations. Now, the history of representations does not cover all of cultural history, but it covers part of it. This book by Paul Fossil, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, the Great War and Modern Memory, which, as you can see, won important awards. It won the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award. Although you notice that in these two awards, you know there's a lot of prizes you can get for books, but in these two awards you will notice that there is not the word history or historians. It's not the National History Book Award, it's the National Book Award. So it's obviously it's bigger, but it also it's not necessarily... So what did Paul Fossil do in this very influential book? He looked at the different ways which novelists had represented the First World War. That was the idea. So it's a history of representation. And also, he talked about the differences and similarities between novels and autobiographies. Yeah, a lot of soldiers who lived through the war wrote their autobiography, and other people who lived through the war or did not live through the war wrote novels. And for Paul Fossil, in fact, these are actually very close. Because when you write an autobiography, you are selecting very, very heavily. You want to give a particular image of yourself, etc. And so he said, you know, there's a lot of things coming together there. A second example in the area of cultural history. We're still in cultural history now. If at the end of the class you're still not sure what cultural history is, that's okay. I'm not sure what cultural history is. But you have to have some ideas about it. It's a very complicated thing. A second example here, Nicholas Offenstadt, who is also the author of the Cursage I recommended to you on historiographie. A very nice guy. He wrote this book, 1418... Sorry, 14-18 aujourd'hui, 14-18 aujourd'hui, which is a very, very bizarre idea, you know. He's a historian, he's a real historian, he has written some books about what happened 100 years ago, but this is about 1914 to 1918, today. But today, it's a new idea, and what he does he collects a series of 21st century French representations of the war. Rock songs about the First World War. There are he found 35 rock songs about the First World War, poems, bande dessinée, comic books, cinema. Of course, there are many, many films about the First World War. But also, he studied the different organisations, the voluntary organisations who reconstitute the battles. You know that some people like to dress up as First World War soldiers and reconstitute the battle. Okay? Any reconstitution fans here? It's a bit of a boy thing, isn't it? Yes. Okay. And so he puts all this together, and I wrote this in French. La question posée est celle du sens donné à cet événement historique par la population d'aujourd'hui. Okay, so that's the idea. So you can see history of representation. So actually, about today, it's very good, actually. There's a whole section on rock music, which is quite stunning. Okay, Fossil and Offenstadt. Now, that's what you would expect from cultural history, is a big section about representations, either representations at the time, yeah, how did soldiers feel about food, or representations today, like Mr. Offenstadt. But there is a section of cultural history which talks about culture at the time. So you can see here, we have the arts, entertainment, and propaganda during the war. So this, in one way, is more traditional because we're talking about things which happened between 1914 and 1918 and not what people today think of it. Yeah. This is theatre and so on. Now, this is also history of representations because propaganda is representations. And you have to be careful, even if you're a government and you're making propaganda for the war, you have to be careful, because if your propaganda is not subtle at all, it won't work. you have to be actually quite intelligent. What is the question which will pull people along? And what are the things I need not to say? So, actually talking about the culture at the time, and of course the work which I do on popular song during the First World War is exactly in this area. You know, what were people singing about? And when I began to look at it, the first surprising thing, I found a few surprising things. This is good because if you don't find anything surprising, it's not going to be a very exciting book. And the first thing is that 3/4 of popular songs in Britain during the First World War say nothing at all about the war in any way and don't talk about living in the war, etc. Now, this actually is quite obvious in a way, because if you imagine you're going out every Friday and every Saturday night to the musical, do you want to listen all evening to songs about the war? Obviously not. You want to escape from it, yeah, and get away with it. So that was one. But so it was obvious, but you had to find it. The second thing that I found that was what I thought was surprising is that there are no British popular songs about hating Germans. And there are lots of French popular songs about hating Germans in the war years. In front, yeah, le chien du Bosch, is a famous at the time a very popular song in France, and it's a story of a prisoner of war who is very badly treated, and finally a German dog, brings him water, and it's parce que même un chien a plus de cœur qu'un Bosch. C'est subtil, hein? Yeah. And that was there were lots of songs in France about hating Germans, and no songs in Britain. And of course, that's interesting. But of course, the real question is why. And I found out why. Well, in France, the why is easy because, in fact, if you remember your Histoire en Troisième. The French were already angry with the Germans before the First World War, after the defeat in 1870 or 71, I can't remember, when the Germans got Alsace and Lorraine. Yeah, there were lots and lots of popular songs. We hate the Germans because they've taken Alsace and Lorraine. And secondly, in France, all young men went on military service. And so there was and what do you do on military service mostly? Get bored. It's extremely boring. You're just there. There's no women. There's nothing to do. And so you sing. You sing a lot. And so there's a whole collection of songs, of military service songs, and many of them are about hating the Germans. In Britain, on the other hand, completely different situation. First of all, the British and the Germans were very close, not because Victoria was Kaiser Wilhelm's cousin, because most people didn't know Queen Victoria. They all care about her. No, it's because there were many, many Germans living in England. They were attracted to London to get a job. And in particular, in music, the German band was a standard feature in the pubs of London. Yeah, let's go and listen to the German band. So they were actually very close. And so although, of course, once the war began, the British and the Germans also wanted to win the war. Nevertheless, getting everybody to sing together about how horrible the Germans were doesn't seem to be possible. This is also because of the nature of the music hall. If you're a singer in 1915 or 1916 in Britain, you have 3,000 people or 2,000 people in the theatre. Everybody must sing the chorus. If only half the audience sing, you might lose your job. Everybody must sing. And so you cannot put anything controversial in there. And although there are probably people who would like to sing about hating Germans, I think, this is my opinion, you couldn't guarantee that everybody would sing along. So those are just a couple of the surprising things I found. Some of the things I found were not so surprising. For example, the British don't really have songs about sex, and the French have lots of songs about sex. It's terrible. It's a total stereotype, and it's actually true for the songs of the First World War. So, cultural history, very interested in representations, very interested in including representations in art, literature, theatre, song, cinema, monuments, etc. It's all representations. And the final theme, which is tremendously important to cultural historians, and which will introduce our other topic for the seminar, is commemoration. Because commemoration is part of representation, yeah? Obviously, if you're going to, hey, let's get together and commemorate, obviously you will only do it if you think it's important. Yeah? I don't know. If it's 10 years since they replaced the lamps in the streets, we're not going to organize a special ceremony to celebrate 10 years. But universities do things. You know, there was a thing, what was it recently? It was the 50 years of the University of Rouen. I don't know if many people cared, but somebody cared because they organized it. The institution cared because they organized a big thing. It was last year, I think, the 50 years of the University of Rouen. Did you notice this? Ça vous dit quelque chose? Il y avait un anniversaire les 50 ans de l'Université de Rouen. Ça vous a pas frappé trop? Vous n'avez même pas vu les affiches l'année dernière? Mm. Si, ça vous dit vaguement quelque chose. Moi aussi, hein, c'est pas trop mon truc, but it was obviously important to somebody. So what other kinds of preoccupations might we see in the cultural history of the First World War? So again, cultural history of modern war, this is by Michael Roper. The secret battle, emotional survival in the Great War. Tout un programme. So here this guy wants to ask the question, and it's really a question we all ask. You can imagine these soldiers, and we know a little bit about it, the trenches and the danger and you know, watching your friends be blown to bits and so on. How did they survive emotionally? That's the question. And this is what he tries to do with this. He wrote a whole book about how did soldiers survive emotionally. So you can see this is history, but it's also psychology. Yeah, if you were writing a book about emotional survival in the Great War, if you're not a psychologist, you go and talk to a psychologist to have some idea about what's going on. Yeah, so it's interdisciplinary. Now, it's also a little bit controversial. You know, some people think it's impossible for us to understand. Yeah, some people think this is not a good book, not a possible book, because we are so far from their realities that we can't really understand. Whereas other people say, no, we can. And I think that in this book, his corpus, because you know how we like to have a corpus, because if you don't have a corpus, you might just be collecting anecdotes. Not good. And his corpus is letters to their mother. He's based on letters which soldiers wrote to their mothers, which is very interesting because mothers were, I mean, most people like their mothers. I don't want to know. If you don't like your mother, I don't want to know. Most people like their mothers, but certainly in working class British culture, mothers have always had a very special role. We have a stereotype about Italians loving their mother, don't we? Yeah. But in British working class culture, it's very interesting. If you go to Liverpool, traditionally on the docks in Liverpool, you'd have these big sailor guys, and they had tattoos everywhere. And very typically, they had tattooed, "I love my mother." Now, I have seen enormous Liverpool lads, you know, the sort of guy who you'll be very polite to, because really quite scary guys, and they have, you know, "I love my mum," with a big heart, tattooed on their shoulders. This is not rare, yeah? So this is really interesting. And that may be one of the reasons that they chose. To go back to my own subject, I like to talk about my subject. In the popular songs, there are many songs which mock people. Yeah, they mock the husband, they mock the wife a lot, they mock the children, they mock father, and nobody mocks the mother. In the songs, there are no songs about mocking mothers. In fact, the songs about mothers are very idealistic. You know, "Ireland must be heaven, for my mother comes from there," is the title of the song. It's very sweet, yeah. Lots and lots of mother thing. That hard-working mother of mine, and so on. There would be a book to write about the representation of mothers in popular song, because today we have something different. How many modern popular songs do you know about mothers? It's not a common subject. It's not a common subject. I remember a recent one about fathers. C'est qui la française qui, ou le français, je ne sais pas si c'est un garçon ou une fille qui chante sur le fait que son père n'est pas là. Yeah? Voilà. Yeah. So, well, but mothers, you know, mothers. 100 years ago in Britain, they sang about mothers. Yeah, let's sing about how wonderful our mothers are. It's like, it's a... So the secret battle, here's another example of cultural history. Fighting different wars. This is by Janet Watson. I note this because it's, you know, it's more and more we have women involved in writing history. And some people think that cultural history and more women historians go together. That there may be a particular view. I don't really know, actually, if that's true or not, but I know that some people think it. And I don't know if you can read this. Fighting different wars, experience, memory, and the First World War in Britain. Experience, memory, and the First World War in Britain. There they are, fighting different wars. And one more, I think. A war imagined. I can't read that. Yeah, okay, a war imagined. I can't actually remember the subject of that one. I can't even remember the subject of that one. In any case, there we are with the basic ideas of cultural history, and I'll just be moving into my second file here. When you get into commemoration, then there are many possibilities, because the First World War, of course, is a series of events and a series of experiences, but it's also a political symbol. And more in some parts of the country than others. For example, in Portugal, the First World War was considered by the elite. The Portuguese joined the First World War halfway through and didn't do very much, actually, to be frank. I think they had one battle. Yeah, it was just a small intervention. But it was very important for the elite of Portugal, because for the elite of Portugal, joining the First World War was becoming a modern country. Yeah, it was an old-fashioned rural country. It was also a very unstable country. They kept having coup d'etats every 6 minutes. But the idea was that if we join the British and the Russians in the First World War, we are a modern country. So that's interesting. So it's like, what did the war mean to people? Do you know something about Portugal? You were looking like you knew what I was talking about. Oh no, you're just nodding. That's great. It's encouraging. Good. And in Ireland. In Ireland, the First World War is tremendously important. Now, Ireland had a specific position within the United Kingdom. Perhaps you remember that Ireland is still part of the United Kingdom until after the First World War. And Ireland was completely divided. In general, in Britain, that is to say, in England, in Scotland, the majority of people thought, well, the war is necessary. Suppose better join the army. They weren't necessarily enthusiastic, but it was accepted. Whereas in Ireland, people were completely divided. In the north, you had Protestants and Catholics. I simplify a little bit. The Protestants thought it was wonderful. The British Empire. The northern Protestants were very close link with the empire, and so they had no problems joining the army. And the Catholics, who in general wanted more autonomy for Ireland, the Catholics were divided. One section of the Catholics said, if we support the war, if we work very hard to support the British Empire, then after the war, they will see that we deserve more autonomy. Not necessarily independence, but more autonomy. Ireland will be treated better, thought many Catholics, if we support the British in the First World War. On the other hand, another group of Catholics, another group of nationalists, said, no, don't be stupid. Now is the right time to organise a rebellion. Where is the British Army? The British Army is in France. Let's declare independence and become a free Republic of Ireland, as we have been dreaming of for 500 years. because every century or so, 1798, in the 1830s, there were often rebellions against English rule in Ireland. So the Catholic, well, the nationalists to be precise, were absolutely divided. And so today, today there is a big problem remembering the First World War in Ireland, in the south of Ireland, in the north of Ireland. Because for the unionists in the north, these are the Protestants, he says you better syndicaliste ici, mais unioniste, ceux qui croient que l'Irlande du Nord doit rester dans l'union avec l'Angleterre. For the unionists, the First World War is wonderful. Yeah, the Irish were great heroes defending the British Empire, whereas other sections of the Irish population see it quite differently. I will come back to Ireland next week. So here you have a book, again, Catherine Schweitzer, and you see that now we have some women involved. Unionists and Great War commemoration in the north of Ireland between 1914 and 1939. Now, even today, there is a lot of commemoration in the north of Ireland of the First World War. There are many murals. You know that the towns of, perhaps you don't know, the towns of Northern Ireland have many political murals, paintings on the walls. It's a tradition. Many of them are about the First World War. That is to say that today, people are painting on the walls of their houses, on the outside walls of their houses, representation of the First World War, because it's extremely important to them. And so here is an example. So this is about commemoration, but it's about commemoration in a specific period. Not commemoration today. Yeah, Mr. Offenstadt's book was about today. What are the representations today? Whereas this is, it's a kind of double history book. This is the history of how people in the between 1914 and 1939, considered the events of 1914 to 1918. So it's kind of a double history book. It's the history of what people in the past thought about events in the further past. Yeah. So it gets quite sophisticated at times. Here's another one: War, Memory, and Popular Culture. This is a collection of essays, so it's more theoretical. Essays on modes of remembrance and commemoration. I actually don't understand the title of this book. So let's first of all take modes of commemoration. Des réflexions sur des modes de la commémoration. What is a mode of commemoration? I know what commemoration is, okay? What is a mode of commemoration? I don't know. But what's even weirder is that remembrance is, the meaning of the word remembrance is fundamentally commemoration. And so this, like, modes of commemoration and commemoration. It can become rather abstract. Yeah? If you ever work in history, you must remember sometimes the history book you're reading is not very good. Yeah, you sometimes when you're a student, you say, "Wow, it's a book. It must be good because he wrote a book." Yeah, but some of them are quite mad. I don't know this one very well, but Essays on Modes of Remembrance and Communion. I don't really understand the title. It's not a good sign. It's not a good sign when your professor doesn't understand the title. That's not good. Okay, so what was I doing here? Oh, la, la. I'm not sure if I can even read that. Commemoration. Okay. One more. The Politics of War Memory and Commemoration. This is a little, I understand this one. Because as I'm sure you can quite easily understand, commemorating the war is very political. Yeah? It's very political. You say, okay, it's 100 years since the last war. Let's make a new monument to the glory of the people of Rouen who were killed, of the soldiers of Rouen who were killed in the war, our heroes. This is not neutral, it's political. Because if you take particularly the word heroes, there is a charity in Britain called Help for Heroes, and they give money to soldiers who were wounded. But it's all very political because, of course, you see, let's check it. What is a hero? What is a hero? What sort of thing does a hero do? No, not a superhero, just a hero, a human being who's a hero. What kind of thing does a human hero do?
Good deeds.
Good deeds, yeah. You must be brave to be a hero, yes, that's right, okay. Yeah. So you must do things where you don't show your fear, you ignore your fear. Okay. Is this enough, if you're very brave and you do something very dangerous, is this enough to be a hero? Or do you need something else? Yeah. You could save somebody or not. Yeah, that would certainly help. It certainly helps if you save people. Yeah, but it's not absolutely necessary, I don't think, to save somebody. But there is something else that's necessary. It's not enough to be very brave. Yeah. You could sacrifice yourself. Certainly, yes, I recommend. Do sacrifice yourself. No, thank you. Yeah. Certainly, yeah. Certainly. So that's sacrifice, bravery. Those are important. But there's something else as well that you haven't thought of because. If you imagine it's very scary to take a gun and go and attack people. But if you think of the terrorists we've seen around Europe recently, they were probably brave. It's very scary, but they're not heroes. You could say they were brave, yeah, because they were just like everybody else. But they're not heroes because to be a hero, you must also be right. Yeah, you must be in a just cause. Yeah. It's just like, you know, the soldiers of the Nazi armies were probably approximately as brave as the soldiers of the anti-Nazi armies, because, you know, why not? But we don't call the Nazi soldiers heroes because they were wrong, yeah? So to be a hero, you need to be brave and right. You need to be in a just cause. And this is why it's political to put up a side to the First World War, especially the First World War, to our heroes, yes? It means we were right. And this is interesting. Of course, a difficult question. Were the British right in the First World War? The Second World War is even more complicated. But the First World War, the general opinion of the British people today is that the First World War was not a good thing. That it would not have been... it would have been better to avoid... That it was not necessary. Nobody really. Very few people defend the First World War. Many people defend the Second World War because, oh, you know, it was horrible, the Second World War. But you know, Hitler, fascism, anti-Semitism. Most people think it was necessary. Whereas the First World War has a very bad press. In the First World War, you know. Do you know people who defend the First World War? That was a good thing, good idea, the First World War. Congratulations to the people who organized. I don't think you see so many. It's got a pretty bad press, the First World War, and with some reason. Okay, so the politics of war memory and commemoration, that it is political. Now, that's not a negative thing. In any case, if you're frightened of politics, you can't be a historian, because lots of things are political, even when you didn't think they were, often they are. And here you have the example here. I don't know if you recognize, this is the boy who's going to be executed for cowardice. This is the boy who's going to be executed. And so obviously that's very political. There's been a big debate. I mentioned this recently. There's been a big debate in Britain, and they decided to pardon all of the executed. And there's a big debate in France, and for the moment they have not decided to pardon. So it must be political, or it would be no problem. So, okay, pardon you. So it must be political because that's why they don't want to do it. And here's another book of cultural history about commemoration. Battlefield tourism. I've been to a number of the... has anybody else here been to one of the First World War battlefields? Verdun, Le Chemin des Dames, or Péronne et tout ça. Okay, well, it's my job, so I went to some of them. And what is interesting about them is that I don't drive. And so I was in Paris, and I wanted to go to visit the battlefields. And I thought, well, maybe somebody organises a bus. There might be a bus, you know, a tourist bus. And you can get a tourist bus to visit the battlefields in France of the Great War from London, but not from Paris. It is something which is much more popular among British. And if you get this bus and you go to the battlefields, it's very, very interesting. and you see large numbers of Australians and Americans and Canadians and very few French people, except for the school children who are being dragged along. Come and see some history. Yeah. And it's certainly true that the commemoration of the Great War, of the First World War, is much more important in Britain than in France, and much more important in Australia. In Australia, it's a national religion, that people come from Australia today to see the battlefields of the First World War in France, or in Turkey, where the many Australians were killed. And people your age will do that, you know, and it's not that unusual. Whereas, you know, if you said, the equivalent would be, imagine you said to your friends, "Oh, I'm going to go to Indochina because my grandfather was in the army in Indochina, and I want to see the battlefields." Well, all your friends are thinking, "You're a bit strange, really. It was not an unusual thing to do." Yeah, on fait pas des pèlerinages en Indochine pour commémorer les soldats français qui la dû avoir des morts sans aucun doute puisqu'ils ont perdu. So there is something very specific about the Great War, and now there is a reason why it's more important to the British, which is perhaps not the reason you think, but I will come back to that probably next week. Okay, so just to summarise on cultural history, what is it? Very, very difficult, but certainly one of the aspects is it's a very wide view of culture. If you were in my third year class last year about popular culture, I told you a little bit about Raymond Williams, and he said that culture is not just art and singing and dancing. It's also just the way you do things, the unspoken and automatic ways. For example, the way you treat friends is different in Japan and in France. They have different cultures. The word friend has a different meaning, in fact, in different countries. So that would be culture too. So of course, when we say culture immediately, we think, oh yes, dance, music, museums and so on. But culture is also just ways of living together in society. So the cultural historians, first of all, have a very wide view of culture. You saw one of the books was about food. Now, food is culture, obviously, because if you go to, one of my friends is in China right now, and he's been eating insects, which is fine if you're in China, but you know, that's a different culture. You know, we have difficulty eating insects. Secondly, cultural history distanced itself, moved away from previous approaches to culture. Because before cultural history, of course, people did write about culture, but they did it in particular ways. I will put the slides up on the blog at some point, so you don't get everything. They did it in particular ways. Two of the classic ways before cultural history to write about culture were, first of all, history of art. History of art still exists today, and it has existed for a long time. And historians, we are all a little bit suspicious in secret about history of art. What is history of art? Well, it works for music as well, and you might recognize it, but let's take art. Very often, history of art is looking at a famous artist and saying, which other artists influenced this artist? What is the history of this technique, chiaroscura, perspective and so on? The history of techniques in art, the history of influences between one artist and another artist. Can you see what I'm getting at? That the history of art has often studied art separate from society. Just which artists influenced, which techniques were used. You see this in other areas of art as well. For example, popular music. If you are a great fan of Ice Cube or I Am or Immortal Technique, if you read an article about them, it will very often tell you, oh yes, this influence came from here, and he was influenced by it. It's all about influences. And so that's history too. But that's like history of art. It's where you don't really look too much at what's happening in society. So if you're writing the history of rap music, you might think that there is a particular reason that rap arrives at a particular moment. Before rap music, techno was house music. Techno music was very popular, and they're quite opposite in a way, because techno music is the only modern popular music in the West where you don't have words. And it was maybe for people, if you were ungenerous, you could say it was for people with nothing to say. And rap is the opposite. There are so many words. It seems to be music for people who have so much to say, they have to speak very fast. Something's going on there. Okay, so history of art is like separating on. History of ideas is the same idea. It's the same sort of thing. Yeah, history of ideas is it's a bit like sometimes what you do in philosophy. Is that you look at Daniel Defoe, for example. I know you were talking about him earlier, and you say, "Oh well, which writers influenced this writer?" And taking the texts and taking them out of history. Now, my colleagues who work in history of ideas would not be happy with me for saying this, because I'm suggesting that they're not real historians. But if you don't tell them, that's okay. Cultural history also then moved away from history of art and history of ideas because it was concentrated on what is measurable. Yeah, can you measure it? Not necessarily in numbers, but you have to have concrete reality. One of the difficulties of, if you just write, for example, if you write about what were the 1980s like? What were the 1990s like? What were the 2000s like? Journalists do this a lot. Yeah. Oh yes, in the 2000s people were like this, and then after 2010 people were like this. But it can be very abstract. You know, you're very, very quack. It's a journalistic thing. You know. Oh yeah. Before 2010, young people were like this, and now today young people are like this. Well, maybe, but it very quickly it can just be opinion. Yeah. So cultural historians are always interested. They still need a corpus. Yeah. So emotional survival seen through the letters they wrote to their mothers. Or food seen through, you still have a specific corpus, so it's still history from that point of view. And finally, just like social history, it's generally a history from below. Yeah, so it's not just about kings and generals. Cultural history is not about kings and generals and dukes and prime ministers. That's the more traditional view of history. For the First World War, it was military and diplomatic, but also for history in general, very, very popular history is the history of kings and of prime ministers and dictators and what they did. Yeah, and this is, it's still very dominant today outside the universities. Inside the universities, not so much. Yeah, if you want to do a doctoral thesis in history about Louis XVI and what he did, you will not find anybody to let you do this, because it's not really seen as history anymore. Yeah, you would have to have some very specific angle. The individual Louis XVI, there's been so much written about him that you probably wouldn't get away with that. You'd have to say something, you'd have to write, if you wanted to write about Louis XVI, it would have to be something like masculine friendship in the court of Louis XVI at Versailles. You could write a book about that, yeah. Or feminine friendship, but something very specific. But about large groups of people and not about individuals. The strong points of cultural history, then, concentration on lived experience. We want to talk about what was it like to live in this particular area, in this particular time, in this particular culture. And secondly, and most importantly, widening of the historical object. 50 years ago, food was not an object of historical study. And today it can be. Emotional survival. Yeah. 50 years ago, if you imagine your time machine, I don't know if you can be a historian in a time machine, but let's say, if you go back to the 1950s, you go to university and say, I want to study emotional survival of the First World War. So, yeah, no, I think you need to go to the psychology department. Go away. This is not history. So today, cultural history has certainly opened up much wider. What is history? What is a historical object? I was just looking at an example of women's letters to the newspaper during the First World War, in the this particular Scottish newspaper, they, every day they had letters from readers, and most of them were from men, but about one in five or one in six were from women. And somebody collected all the women's letters to this newspaper for the war years to analyse what was important to the women who wrote. Now, those are the strong points of cultural history. The criticisms which has been made of it is that it can ignore important institutions like the state. That is to say that sometimes cultural history says there is society, or the war, or modern France, and then you, the individual. And the problem with this is that if you don't, to understand the individual, you also have to look at social class, organisations, institutions like universities, and so on. So how you live, how your image of society is also organised by trade unions, universities, family, and so on. And sometimes cultural history has a lot of individuals and the culture, and this can be a weakness. Now, of course, the cultural historians deny it, but you know. And finally, it can suggest a uniformity of culture which does not exist in nature. This is a very, very difficult culture. At the moment, they're discussing in Britain, you know, multiculturalism and individual cultures, and sometimes it gets very difficult, you know, because if you go to London and you find some young people, and you find one Muslim, and you find one Catholic, and you find one Protestant, and you find one Jew, and you say, okay, now tell me about your culture, and all four of them will say, we love Game of Thrones. Yeah, I'm exaggerating, of course, but the idea that there is, for example, in Britain today, a Muslim culture and a Catholic culture, it's not so easy, yeah? Because really we do, it's like, you know, we talk about, people always tell me about French culture and how important to French culture is good food. Okay, and now, so how many people had pizza last night? How many people had traditional French food last night? Raise your hand. How many people had good. How many people had Italian food last night? Yeah. How many people had Chinese food last night? How many people didn't have enough money to buy any food at all? Okay. You see the problem that it can be. Of course, it's still true, I think, that food is more important in France than in Britain. But I wouldn't like to get into any great detail about it, because, as you know, if you go out to a restaurant, if you don't have a lot of money, it's easier to go to Greek or Turkish or Italian, not French, unless you're a rich and well-paid university professor like myself. It's true. I'm going to have just a 5-minute break and then continue.